Welcome to Chasing American History. We're going to take a little detour today. We're not doing the third section of George Washington 101, so please come back next week. We will probably have it next week. But as I'm recording this, it is Bob Dylan's birthday. So I woke up today and I decided to do something a little different. Today we're going to talk about Bob Dylan's music in terms of history. That means the music he wrote when he really knew he was writing about history, not what he wrote in terms of immediate events that became historical, that became important in terms of history. If I did that, we'd be here forever. So I don't want to do that, but I do want to emphasize how important history is to Bob Dylan and how important American history is to Bob Dylan. You know, one of my favorite pictures of Dylan is when he was in Paris in 1966. It's in the midst of the Vietnam War. There is tremendous anti-American sentiment in Paris, throughout the world, really. Bob Dylan is considered by many people the leader of the hippies, something he doesn't agree with, the leader of the anti-authoritarian group of people. Certainly people assume that he is a strong opponent of the Vietnam War. And he comes to Paris and he comes out on that stage, and then behind him opens up a giant American flag that he sings in front of. Doesn't talk about it. That's not what Bob Dylan does. But throughout that tour, when America is being condemned by so many people, he's always singing in front of this American flag. At one time, people are yelling at him and he goes, "This isn't British music, this is American music." Bob Dylan has performed every kind of indigenous American music that we have. He has performed the old kind of folk and the newer kind of folk. He has performed rock music. He has performed gospel music. He's performed a little bit jazz. He certainly listens to a lot of jazz. He's performed rap. Now, for those of you who say, well, wait a minute, Bob Dylan hasn't performed rap, you've all heard Subterranean Homesick Blues, Johnny's in the Basement, Mixing Up the Medicine, I'm on the Pavement, Thinking About the Government, The Man in the Trench Coat, Badge Out, Laid Off, Says He's Got a Bad Cough, Wants to Get Paid Off. Now, I don't know a lot about rap. This may shock you, but I'm pretty much limited to the Alexander Hamilton musical. But I do know that rap stars have talked about Bob Dylan and the effect he had, not just that song, but the type of lyrics that he writes, the way he takes on authority, what he does. What I'm trying to say here is Bob Dylan is part of every type of Americana when it comes to music. The most recent recordings Bob Dylan has made have been called The Great American Songbook. It's Bob Dylan singing songs that were made famous by people like Frank Sinatra and Hoagy Carmichael. And you might think, well, wait a minute, how can Bob Dylan take on these songs that Frank Sinatra sang? Well, he comes at them from a different perspective, but he definitely brings you close to the meanings of these songs, sometimes closer than you've ever been before. Now, I have two different books here that I'm going to use to discuss things on this episode. One is the book that Bob Dylan wrote, Chronicles. And in Chronicles, he talks a great deal about the meaning the Civil War has to him and has to the country. And the other book I'm going to use is a book called Lyrics. That's the book that has all of the lyrics of Bob Dylan. But first, I have to give out a couple of shout-outs. First, to The Great Courses. This is a collection of the best college-level courses that are on CD and DVD and digital formats. They have over 500 expertly produced courses that are given by professors chosen for their ability to teach from throughout the nation. And it is now possible to order one of these things, and within 5 minutes, boom, it's on your telephone, it's on your iPad. So a really wonderful thing. Also, the notes are on your iPad, the outline, the bibliography. I've been listening to these for years and years, and they're definitely a wonderful source. The other thing I want to tell you about is the Museum of the American Revolution that just opened up here in Philadelphia. You can go there and you can see George Washington's original wartime tent, and you can discover how American colonists became revolutionaries. I went out and saw it the day it was opened, and I'm delighted to tell you that it's a very good museum. Also, of course, I have to talk about Bow Tie Tours. This is the best historical walking tour in Philadelphia and the surrounding areas. We make history come alive in the city of Philadelphia, and we also offer in-depth looks at nearby battles at Washington's Crossing, which also includes Trenton and Princeton, all part of kind of the same series of 10 days, and Brandywine and Monmouth. So if you're truly interested in American history, contact Bowtie Tours at 610-642-2410. We also offer something called the Independence Tour Extraordinaire, and that's a tour that includes entrance into several of the sites in Philadelphia. It includes entrance into Independence Hall, which is sometimes somewhat difficult to get the tickets for that. Entrance into the Declaration House, where Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, and entrance into the Second National Bank, where they have a portrait studio now with some of the most famous portraits of our founders. So if you're really interested, if you're coming into Philadelphia, you want to look up Independence Tour Extraordinaire or give us a call at 610-642-2410. Okay? All right. And now, Bob Dylan in history. Now, as I told you, I'm going to use the book that Bob Dylan wrote, which is called Chronicles. Anybody interested in Bob Dylan or anybody interested in a very well-written book should go ahead and read Chronicles. It's not exactly a biography or an autobiography. It's more like Hemingway's A Movable Feast. It has these very poignant, sometimes very meaningful moments in his life. And it's a very interesting book. And it's a very interesting way of looking at Bob Dylan. One thing you learn from this book is Bob Dylan is doing everything he can to become the Bob Dylan we know, I suppose. I don't think it's clear to him what he wants to do. He knows he wants to become a folk singer at one point. He knows he wants to write songs at one point. He's not sure what exactly he wants to do, but he's out there. He's visiting New York. Of course, he's born in Duluth, Minnesota. He moves to Minneapolis to go to college out there in the University of Minneapolis, but it's not for him. Pretty quickly, he gets out of there, and he's going to visit New York City. I skipped the Hibbing part, of course. He leaves Duluth as a very young child because his father suffers a disease and is unable to do the work that he did out there, so they go back to family in Hibbing. I visited all of these places, and if you're a real Dylan fan, you'll want to see Hibbing. I really felt like I understood Bob Dylan better after visiting Hibbing, after looking at the high school. I actually got to go inside the high school where he first went electric and where the principal turned off the electricity. Got to see where he had his bar mitzvah. It's an empty building now, but that's all right. Got to see where he used to buy his records. Again, an empty building. Got to see where he saw Rebel Without a Cause. Not an empty building. Now it's a sandwich shop. Got to see different places, but got a feel to the place. You know, I remember Bob Dylan saying in an interview that his father really made fun of him for thinking New York was the center of the world. And the interviewer asked Bob, well, what would your father think is the center of the world? And Bob said, well, wherever he was. And that's kind of the feeling in Hibbing. Hibbing's out in the middle of nowhere. I've been to a lot of towns that are out in the middle of nowhere, although this may be about the smallest. It's about two streets now. But the people don't feel that way. They think they're in the center of the universe. They think this is the greatest place in the world. They think they went to the greatest school in the world. And there's no feeling that they're missing out on anything in Hibbing. So if you felt differently about that growing up, if you felt you were missing out on something, if you spend your nights trying to hook up to the radio station out in Mexico and you want to get these different types of this different type of music and you feel like you're surrounded by people who just don't get it, people who are completely satisfied where they are, that's going to make you a kind of an interesting person. And I think that's somewhat what happened to Bob Dylan. At any event, what's amazing about this book is he talks about all these different things. He talks about French writers, or he talks about listening to Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. He talks about Faulkner. He talks about all this different literature. And he's just voraciously going through everything, and he's grabbing anything that helps. He's grabbing anything that is going to help take him where it is he wants to go. He's not sure where he wants to go, but he has a sense of it. And anything that's going to help, he's going to use. He's going to listen to Hot House in the morning. I think it was Hot House. It was a bebop song. And because that gets him going. That gets him moving. He meets Thelonious Monk. He's in Greenwich Village, he's learning everything, and he's staying with people who have books, and he's looking at these books, and he's starting to think about history. Maybe for the first time, he's starting to think about the Civil War, for instance. But the way he's going to look at history is the way he looks at everything. He looks at the people, he tries to figure out what makes them interesting, what makes them different. And so he says, in one section, it's on page 40, for those of you following along, I read the biography of Thaddeus Stevens, the radical Republican. He lived in the early part of the 1800s and was quite a character. He's from Gettysburg, and he's got a club foot like Byron. He grew up poor, made a fortune, and from then on championed the weak and any other group who wasn't able to fight equally. Stevens had a grim sense of humor, a sharp tongue, and a white-hot hatred for the bloated aristocrats of his day. He wanted to confiscate the land of the slave-holding elite, once referred to a colleague on the floor of the chamber as slinking in his own slime. Stevens was an anti-Mason, and he denounced his foes as those whose mouths reeked from human blood. He got right in there, called his enemies a feeble band of lowly reptiles who shun the light and who lurk in their own dens. Stevens was hard to forget. He made a big impression on me, was inspiring. Him and Teddy Roosevelt, maybe the strongest U.S. president ever. I read about Teddy, too. He was a cattle rancher and a crime buster, had to be restrained from declaring war on California, had a big run-in with J.P. Morgan. Roosevelt backed him down and threatened to throw him in jail. Either one of those guys, Stevens or Roosevelt, could have stepped out of a folk ballad. Ah, so there you have it. He is immersing himself in folk music, and I think that's part of what's driving him to look at history. But he's looking at people. He's looking at what kind of people are the ones we're going to remember, the ones that are a little bit different, the ones that are worth a folk song. Now, Thaddeus Stevens, he's worth a folk song. It's funny, if you read John F. Kennedy's book, Profiles of Courage, he doesn't have very many nice things to say about Thaddeus Stevens. He kind of puts him down. I think Kennedy felt a little differently after he gave his speech in 1963 about civil rights, after he started coming up against some of these Southerners who fought against his civil rights programs and civil rights in general. One day we're going to talk about that speech. That's going to be a series of episodes as well. But Dylan, he's attracted to Thaddeus Stevens. He's attracted to the club foot, attracted to this guy who fights so passionately, who doesn't really play by the rules. He'd be a good subject for a folk song. So that's probably a pretty important thing to him at that time. Thaddeus Stevens, one of the people who takes us to the Civil War, one of the people who pushes Lincoln from the left, who demands that the slaves be freed, who helps push the 13th Amendment through. Somebody that Bob Dylan starts learning about for the first time after he's gone out to New York. Now, let me tell you, let me read you another very interesting part of this book. I did everything fast. Thought fast, ate fast, talked fast, and walked fast. I even sang my songs fast. I needed to slow my mind down if I was going to be a composer with anything to say. I couldn't exactly put in words what I was looking for, but I began searching in principle for it over at the New York Public Library, a monumental building with marble floors and walls, vacuous and spacious caverns, vaulted ceiling, a building that radiates triumph and glory when you walk inside. In one of the upstairs reading rooms, I started reading articles in newspapers on microfilm from 1855 to about 1865 to see what daily life was like. I wasn't so much interested in the issues as intrigued by the language and rhetoric of the times. Newspapers like the Chicago Tribune, the Brooklyn Daily Times, and the Pennsylvania Freeman, others too like the Memphis Daily Eagle, the Savannah Daily Herald, and Cincinnati Inquirer. It wasn't like it was another world, but the same one, only with more urgency. And the issue of slavery wasn't the only concern. There were news items about reform movements, anti-gambling leads, rising crime, child labor, temperance, slave wage factories, loyalty oaths, and religious revivals. You get the feeling that the newspapers themselves could explode and lightning will burn and everybody will perish. Everybody uses the same God, quotes the same Bible and law and literature. Plantation slavecrats of Virginia are accused of breeding and selling their own children. In the northern cities, there's a lot of discontent and debt is piled high and seems out of control. The plantation aristocracy run their plantations like city-states. They're like Roman Republic, where an elite group of characters rule supposedly for the good of all. They've got sawmills, grist mills, distilleries, country stores, etc. Every state of mind opposed by another. Christian piety and weird mind philosophies turned on their heads. Fiery orators like William Lloyd Garrison, a conspicuous abolitionist from Boston who even has his own newspaper. There are riots in Memphis and in New Orleans. There's a riot in New York where 200 people are killed outside of the Metropolitan Opera House because an English actor has taken the place of an American one. Anti-slave labor advocates in flaming crowds in Cincinnati, Buffalo, and Cleveland. That if the southern states are allowed to rule, the northern factory owners would then be forced to use slaves as free laborers. This causes riots too. Lincoln comes into the picture in the late 1850s. He's referred to in the northern press as a baboon or giraffe, and there are a lot of caricatures of him. Nobody takes him seriously. It's impossible to conceive that he would become the father figure that he is today. You wonder how people so united by geography and religious ideals could become such bitter enemies. After a while, you become aware of nothing but a culture of feeling, of black days, of schism, evil for evil, the common destiny of the human being getting thrown off course. It's all one long funeral song. But there's a certain imperfection in the themes, an ideology of high abstraction, a lot of epic, bearded characters, exalted men who are not necessarily good. No one single idea keeps you contented for too long. It's hard to find any of the neoclassical virtues either. All that rhetoric about chivalry and honor, that must have been added later. Even the Southern womanhood thing. It's a shame what happened to the women. Most of them were abandoned to starve on farms with their children, unprotected and left to fend for themselves as victims to the elements. The suffering is endless and the punishment is going to be forever. It's all so unrealistic, grandiose, and sanctimonious at the same time. There was a difference in the concept of time, too. In the South, people lived their lives with sun up, high noon, sunset, spring, summer. In the North, people lived by the clock, the factory stroke whistles and bells. Northerners had to be on time. In some ways, the Civil War would be a battle between two kinds of time. Abolition of slavery didn't even seem to be an issue when the first shots were fired at Fort Sumter. It all makes you feel creepy. The age that I was living in didn't resemble this age, but yet it did. In some mysterious and traditional way. Here's Bob Dylan going to the New York Library, this big, beautiful library. I don't know if people can understand in this day and age what it used to be like to find yourself in one of those libraries. Seems to me that nowadays you go to a library and you don't get to go right up to the books. Most of the libraries I go to have a few books, but you order them, they bring them to you. And you can find yourself surrounded by millions of books when you turn on your computer or you look at A-books. Back then, you went to the library, that was the only place you were going to see a lot of these books. And you found books not by looking them up in the card catalog necessarily, but by just going to the subject and going from book to book. When I first started really falling in love with history, I would go to the Boston Library. I remember getting there early one morning and waiting for them to open the door. I got there too early, and I was pacing around waiting to get in there. And I would go in there and I was studying the Kennedy administration, and I was studying the period around that time. I was studying Eisenhower and Joe McCarthy and learning about Bob Dylan, too, at that time. And I'm looking at all of these books that are out there, and I would stay there until they kicked me out of it. I was in jazz music school, so I was in a little trouble here because I wasn't spending my days practicing anymore. I was spending my days going to the Boston Library and trying to grab as much history as I could. And just like Bob Dylan, I didn't know what I was after. But sometimes you have to follow things in that way. What Bob Dylan is probably really doing is studying human beings. He's studying what makes events. He's trying to look at events and really get underneath them and figure out what's causing them, which any great historian needs to do. The greatest historian that I know of right now is Robert Caro. And that's because he doesn't accept anything just because it's been written. He goes back and he makes sure it's true. And you realize when you have someone as great as Robert Caro out there, how many historians are just depending on the work of prior historians. And many times they shouldn't be. Many times a mistake gets made just because it was said by one historian maybe 200 years ago. Nobody has the time to go back and look at everything. There's a reason, of course, that Robert Caro's books take him about 7 to 10 years. So I'm not saying that Bob Dylan is a historian, but I am saying that he's not just receiving history. He's trying to get inside history and find out what it means. I think that statement about it's a battle between two times is very wise. I went to law school in Lexington, Virginia, and at first, they couldn't even understand me. I would go up to them and I would say something and they would say, well, you're gonna have to slow down so I can understand you. And after a while, I did slow down. There's definitely, at least when I was there, this was about 25 years ago now, but it was a different world from the North and time was a different thing. What were they fighting about in the Civil War? Well, some people tell Bob Dylan they're fighting about slavery. Other people say, nah, it's not about slavery. It had nothing to do with slavery. And he goes into that in some of the conversations he had. Talking about a friend that he's speaking to about the Civil War, Ray, who was from Virginia, had ancestors who had fought on both sides of the war. I'd lean back against the wall and shut my eyes, their voices drifting into my head like voices talking from another world. They talked about dogs and fishing and forest fires, love and monarchies and the Civil War. Ray had said that New York City was the city that won the Civil War, came out on top, that the wrong side had lost, that slavery was evil, and that the thing would have died out anyway, Lincoln or no Lincoln. I heard him say it and thought it was a mysterious and bad thing to say, but if he said it, he said it, and that's all there is to it. Well, then he goes and he asks Dave Von Ronk about what he thinks about that, and this is what Dave Von Ronk is going to say. Van Ronk could talk all day about socialist heavens and political utopias, bourgeois democracies and Trotskyites and Marxists and international workers' orders. He could grasp all that stuff firmly, but about states' rights he almost looked bemused. The Civil War was fought to free the slaves, he said. There's no mystery to it. But then again, Van Ronk would never let you forget that he had his own way of seeing things. Look, my man, even if those elite southern barons would have freed their captives, it wouldn't have done them any good. We still would have gone down there and annihilated them, invaded them for their land. It's called imperialism. Van Ronk took the Marxist point of view. It was one big battle between two rival economic systems, is what it was. Bob Dylan may have decided he didn't want to go to college, but that didn't mean he didn't want to learn. Quite the opposite. He felt college would hold him back, I'm sure. But here he is, listening, reading. He's spending his time going to the library. He's reading through these microfilm. He's listening to Von Ronk. He's listening to Ray. He's listening to all these different people. He's reading all these things. And for the first time in his life, he's going to really start to think about history. He's going to read everything he can get his hands on. This becomes a very educated man. If you watch his movie, Masked and Anonymous, one of the first lines in it is a joke that alludes to Aeschylus, which you're not going to see in many movies. So he's a lot like Benjamin Franklin in that way. He doesn't go to school, but he picks up on more knowledge than anybody around him. Maybe that's why Bob Dylan and Benjamin Franklin have something in common. They are both doctors, and for the same reason. They both received an honorary degree from St. Andrews in Scotland. Benjamin Franklin showed up for his ceremony on time. Bob Dylan did not, but they both received an honorary degree from St. Andrews. So if you ever have a trivia question about what Bob Dylan and Benjamin Franklin have in common, now you're going to know. Now we're going to look at some of these songs that are about history that Bob Dylan has written, and I encourage you to go on to iTunes or go to your library, get some of these CDs. Bob Dylan wrote songs. You know, we really misunderstand Shakespeare by the way we teach him. We forget that Shakespeare was not written so that children could be stuck in classrooms reading him. Shakespeare wrote his plays so that they could be performed. And of course, these are songs. Bob Dylan is the first to tell you. He's a songwriter. He writes songs. And so I hope that after you listen to this podcast, you'll go out, you'll hunt up some of these songs, you'll listen to them yourself, because reading to you some of the lines is only one aspect of dealing with these songs. You want to actually listen to them. The first song about an important historical event that Bob Dylan wrote was probably the death of Emmett Till. Probably most of you know about what happened there in Mississippi, one of the most horrific, brutal acts. Emmett Till had either looked at a white woman or said something to a white woman. Now, he was from Chicago, so he wasn't aware of, he was 16, 15, very young man, not even a man yet. He wasn't aware of the rules that seemed to govern Mississippi, the unwritten rules. And this ignorance on his part, this lack of knowing these unwritten rules, resulted in the end of his life. He was beaten to death in a cruel, horrible way. The men who beat him were then tried. The trial is written about brilliantly in Robert Caro's book about Lyndon Johnson, I believe the third volume of his books. Everybody knew these guys did it, but the jury was going to do more than just turn a blind eye. They really wanted to celebrate these men for standing up for womanhood, for standing up for white rights. And it was a trial of great drama. An older African American who was risking his life by testifying testified as to what he saw that night and what he had heard that night, but it didn't matter. Emmett Till's death was going to be condoned by the whites of Mississippi. Is there a bright side? Well, you can't say that there's a bright side if you're Emmett Till or Emmett Till's mother, but this was such a huge event that it really woke up a lot of people in terms of what was going on in areas of the South. The picture of Emmett Till's body, his mother said, "I want people to see what they did to my son." He was brutally beaten, sunk in a lake. And this was something that became worldwide news. So Bob Dylan is going to write about that. Now, his song, The Death of Emmett Till, you have to look at from its time frame. This is not a great song in the way Bob Dylan would learn to write great songs. However, it was a very daring song, and it was a brand new thing to write a song about something like this. Also rather brave of Bob Dylan to write this song about this subject. Called The Death of Emmett Till, he writes, "'Twas down in Mississippi not so long ago when a young boy from Chicago town stepped through a southern door. The boy's dreadful tragedy, I can still remember well. The color of his skin was black, and his name was Emmett Till. Some men, they dragged him to a barn, and there they beat him up. They said they had a reason, but I can't remember what. They tortured him and did some things too evil to repeat. There were screaming sounds inside the barn. There was laughing sounds on the street. When they rolled his body down a gulf amidst a bloody red rain, and they threw him in the waters wide to cease his screaming pain, the reason that they killed him there, and I'm sure it ain't no lie, was just for the fun of killing him, and to watch him slowly die. And then to stop the United States of yelling for a trial, two brothers, they confessed that they had killed poor Emmett Till. But on the jury, there were men who helped the brothers commit this awful crime. And so this trial was a mockery. But nobody seemed to mind." This song was exhilarating for people who believed in civil rights to hear somebody actually putting out there exactly what happened. Because Bob Dylan doesn't just take on the horror of the event, but he takes on the horror of the trial. He takes on all the people who helped, but more than that, he takes on those who are apathetic. Nobody seemed to mind. Those people who think they're good people, but they just go along with the event. If you can't speak out against this kind of thing, a crime that's so unjust, your eyes are filled with dead men's dirt, your mind is filled with dust, your arms and legs, they must be in shackles and chains, and your blood, it must refuse to flow. For you let this human race fall down so god-awful low. The Death of Emmett Till. This is Bob Dylan's statement upon this horrific crime. From the same period is Ballad of Donald White. Donald White was a man convicted of murder, and he received the death penalty as well. And the story, according to Bob Dylan, is that he knew he was in trouble, he tried to get himself into an institution, and he was never able to do so. Dylan writes, "If I had some education to give me a decent start, I might have been a doctor or a master in the arts, but I used my hands for stealing when I was very young, and they locked me down in jailhouse cells. That's how my life begun. And there's danger on the ocean where the salt sea waves split high, and there's danger on the battlefield where the shells of bullets fly, and there's danger in this open world where men strive to be free, and for me the greatest danger was in society. So they asked me to send me back to the institution home, but they said they were too crowded, for me they had no room. I got down on my knees and begged, oh please put me away, but they would not listen to my plea, or nothing I would say. And so it was on Christmas Eve in the year of 59, it was on that night I killed a man I did not try to hide. The jury found me guilty, and I won't disagree, for I knew that it would happen if I wasn't put away. Farewell unto the old north woods of which I used to roam. Farewell unto the crowded bars of which have been my home. Farewell to all you people who think the worst of me. I guess you'll feel much better when I'm on that hanging tree. But there's just one question before they kill me dead. I'm wondering just how much to you I really said concerning all the boys that come down a road like me. Are they enemies or victims of your society?" So here we have Dylan being Guthrie-esque, talking about this one sole person, but he's taking it from somewhat of a different perspective of that time. Certainly there have been a lot of songs written about people like Donald White since then. You got the Springsteen song, Johnny 99 in Nebraska. Johnny Cash did a number of these songs. And here we have Bob Dylan again. This is new. To be looking at a societal question like the way we use our criminal justice system, whether it works, whether there's people who get placed in jail and that makes them more susceptible to crime. Of course, I was a criminal defense attorney for 23 years, so I know that there's a lot of truth in what Bob Dylan's singing about here, whether or not it's true in this case. I remember a friend of mine, Barry, in in college used to say he didn't know whether or not Hurricane was truly guilty or not guilty, but he said it didn't matter. The story of Hurricane was true in so many cases that it didn't matter. And I think there's something to that. I don't know about Donald White. I never investigated Donald White. But I know that there's a number of people who get placed in prison and get turned into criminals and find themselves in a process where they never can get out of the prison because the prison is the one place they're comfortable. And I know that. I've met people like that. And so Bob Dylan is looking at an issue that hasn't really been looked at by people like him and addressing it. Now, by writing these kind of songs, Bob Dylan is becoming the darling of the left, the darling of a certain segment of folk society, and he's really going to secure that position when he writes John Birch Paranoid Blues, and when he refuses to sing on the Ed Sullivan Show because they won't let him sing that song. Of course, making it to the Ed Sullivan Show, if you've seen Bye Bye Birdie, it gives you an idea. That was the pinnacle of success in the time that Bob Dylan was writing these songs. And for Bob Dylan to refuse to be on the show was making quite a statement. But they wouldn't let him sing John Birch Paranoid Blues, talking John Birch Paranoid Blues, because of the possibility of litigation and so forth. I'm not going to go deeply into this song. This is not the songs I'm talking about right now, to a great extent, are period pieces. They don't stand up as great art. He hasn't reached the point where he's able to do that yet. He's going to reach that point, obviously. But Talking John Birch Paranoid Blues is just kind of a farcical talking blues in the way that Woody Guthrie did them, but making fun of these people who were so concerned about communism in the 1950s. So that's an easy thing to do now. We look at, boy, all of our talk shows tonight, and there's pretty vicious characterizations of political sects and so forth, but that wasn't really the way things were back then. And so to stand up and to make fun of the John Birch Society was, again, to do something that's really going to make you a hero to a lot of people. And it takes a little bit of bravery, because this is still the time when these Birchers and others are able to get people shut out. Everybody knows what happened to Pete Seeger at this point. Everybody knew that Pete Seeger wasn't able to get work for a long period of time because these pro-McCarthy people had labeled him a communist. So to sing a song that's going to put you into that box, again, it's something a lot of people might have chosen not to do. And the song just goes through a person who joins the John Birch Society, makes fun of him. I'll quote a little bit. "So I run down most hurriedly and joined up with the John Birch Society. I got me a secret membership card and started off a-walking down the road. Yee-hoo, I'm a real John Bircher now. Look out, you commies. Now, we all agree with Hitler's views. Although he killed 6 million Jews, it don't matter too much that he was a fascist. At least you can't say he was a communist. That's to say, like, if you got a cold, you could take a shot of malaria." You get the idea. Not exactly going to stand up. This isn't one of the Bob Dylan songs we're going to put into a time capsule so people can hear what Bob Dylan did. But this is a historical subject. And again, he's one of the first people to go out there and so clearly enunciate a position on this. Now let's finally move on to a song that is a great Bob Dylan song, a song that Bob Dylan continues to sing. This is on the album Freewheelin' that Bob Dylan put out in 1961, and it's called Masters of War. There's a slight disagreement about what that song means between Bob Dylan and between a lot of his fans. Dylan had done a lot of anti-war songs, and most of his fans, especially at that time, felt that this was just another anti-war song. That's not really the way Bob Dylan saw it. Bob Dylan, as he would come to explain himself, was probably, his point of view is probably similar to President Obama's. You may recall that President Obama, when he went to an anti-war demonstration at the time of the Iraq War, he spoke out against the Iraq War, but he said, "Let's be clear, I'm not anti-war, I'm anti-dumb war, or words to that effect. He said the Iraq war was a dumb war, but that he wasn't there to say that he was opposed to all wars. Again, President Obama had to make that clear when we had that very bizarre circumstance where he was given the Nobel Prize. But again, President Obama had to say that there could be times when he believed that the use of force was necessary and was ethical. This was not an anti-war song that Bob Dylan wrote. This was a song he wrote inspired by President Dwight Eisenhower. When Dwight Eisenhower was president, we had a very fortunate circumstance in a lot of ways because, first of all, we were the only people who had the atomic bomb. We could save a lot of money on standing armies because we didn't have to put as much into them because we had this bomb that we could use to threaten people with. And we had a guy who was president who didn't feel like he had to run around and show that he was pro-military. We had Dwight Eisenhower. Everybody knew he was pro-military. So if he cut the military, people weren't going to attack him. Of course, Joe McCarthy does end up attacking him, but that's part of the end of Joe McCarthy. So at the end of his presidency, Dwight Eisenhower made this incredible final speech in which he spoke about the military-industrial complex. Quote you some of that speech. What President Eisenhower said was this: "In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together." He also said this quote: "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed." Pretty powerful stuff. A speech that often gets quoted, and rightfully so. Now, Bob Dylan, as I say, is not anti-war. Bob Dylan used to dream about dying in battle. Bob Dylan used to want to go to military school. But Bob Dylan is disgusted by the idea of the military-industrial complex, by these people who would push war in order to make money for war. He's disgusted by what he sees the country turning into. And so he writes a riveting, powerful song called Masters of War. This is, I think, the first Bob Dylan song I really fell in love with. I can remember when I went to Berklee School of Music and I heard this song and I would sing this song in the shower. And this is a song that is best recorded by Bob Dylan himself. You hear the power of the words best when you hear this original version that he sang back in 1961. Let me quote you a few of the lines of this very powerful song, which you need to check out on Free Will and Bob Dylan. "Come, you masters of war, you that build all the guns, you that build the death planes, you that build the big bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind desks, I want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy, you play with my world like it's your little toy. Put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes and you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly." On and on it goes, him speaking out to these people who he perceives as his true enemy. Not some other country, but this industrial complex. "You have thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled, the fear to bring children into the world. You've been threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your vein." Now, the song's going to end very powerfully and in a way that made a lot of Bob's leftist fans fairly uncomfortable. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I will follow your casket in the pale afternoon. I'll watch while you're lowered into your deathbed, and I'll stand over your grave to make sure that you're dead. Well, that's not something Pete Seeger would say. That's a very unpleasant thing. And people would sometimes record this song, and they would cut that part out. And Bob Dylan did not appreciate that. He said, you can't cut that part out. You know, this isn't really, I mean, it is a political statement, but it's very personal. And it's obviously a description of how he actually feels, this tremendous anger, hatred. You can't use any other word. He feels hatred for these people who would purposely go out of their way to make money, knowing that they're making money off the deaths of innocent people. He hates the fact that this is creating a fundamental change in the country. You know, he grows up in a country during World War II, and we all know that we didn't have a military-industrial complex to speak of back then. After Pearl Harbor, it took us a great deal of time to build the army. Well, then we have the atomic bomb, then we have Truman. And from that point on, we've always had this industrial complex. And now we have to worry every time we have a war, which we're now in perpetual war. We're in perpetual war. I was watching an old show of Gore Vidal, who I miss very much. And he was talking about Iraq, how they would purposefully knock down certain bridges. And there was already a company with the contract to rebuild the bridge. I don't know if it's true, but that's the kind of world we live in now where that's completely feasible. It's a different world from the one Bob Dylan was born in. And Eisenhower saw what was happening, and Bob Dylan saw what was happening. So check this song out. This is a very important song. This stands up. This is not necessarily a comfortable song. This isn't a song you're going to necessarily sing around a campfire and makes you feel good. It's a distressing song, but it's real. This is what's going on, and there's good reason for this anger that Bob Dylan feels. The country was being subverted in front of his very eyes and turned into something it didn't stand for back in 1776. And so that's pretty distressing. Now let's talk about another classic, brilliant song. This is from the next album, which came out in 1963, The Times They Are A-Changing. Bob Dylan now really the poster child of the American left. That's going to change. Bob Dylan's never going to allow himself to be encompassed by any one political group. But he writes a song that delves into the creation of our history in this country, how we make our history. And as we look at this, again, we need to understand the time it's written in. I now give historical tours, and my concern is there isn't enough discussion of American history. There isn't enough explanation of the founders. I wrote a book about the presidential libraries, and I'm a strong supporter of the presidential libraries. A lot of people argue against them, and they say, well, these are made to aggrandize our country and our presidents. These are created to propagandize people. I argue that on several points, but one point is this. Right now, that's not really a problem. We don't aggrandize our leaders as much as we put them all down. And I think there needs to be a safe center. But when Bob Dylan is growing up, it's a different time. And he's looking at the way in which the youth of his time is propagandized to believe that no matter what America does, it's right. Which we kind of still believe that and feel that in a lot of ways. We're not told now that it's because of our history. We're told it's because we got the most. We have the most money. We have the most power. We're supposed to control the world. We're not really given an ideological basis to do that. But once upon a time, we were given a basis. We were taken through history, and in every segment of history, we were painted as heroes. And of course, that's not true. Nation states do ugly things. Next week, we're going to come back to Washington 101, and we're going to look at the French Indian War, and we're going to look how we're trying to steal land from the Indians. And I'm not supporting creating a tissue of lies. When I grew up, George Washington, the books on George Washington hid some of the less savory aspects. The books on Thomas Jefferson, Dumas Malone, still great books, still worth reading, but you have to not accept them all 100%, any more than you would accept what Arthur Schlesinger writes about John Kennedy. Of course, there's no such thing as impartiality. My college teacher told me that on the first day of class. We should all understand that. Every history book is coming from a partial point of view. But Dylan's point here is that we are telling our children that every war we were the heroes in, and that therefore whatever we do is justified. So he writes, "Oh, my name, it is nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. I's taught and brought up there the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side. Oh, the history books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charged, the Indians fell. The cavalry's charged, the Indians died. Oh, the country was young, with God on its side." And it goes through some of our different wars and how, of course, we're always justified. We're always in the right. When the Second World War, it came to an end, we forgave the Germans, and then we were friends. Though they murdered 6 million in the ovens they fried, the Germans now too have God on their side. I've learned to hate Russians all through my whole life. If another war starts, it's them we must fight, to hate them and fear them, to run and to hide, and accept it all bravely, with God on my side. But now we got weapons of chemical dust. If fire them we're forced to, then fire them we must. One push of the button and a shot the world wide, but you never ask questions when God's on your side. So now as I'm leaving, I'm weary as hell. The confusion I'm feeling ain't no tongue can tell. The words fill my head and fall to the floor. If God's on our side, he'll stop the next war. So this is looking at our history and the way people are manipulated. This is very Orwellian. He's looking at how we use our language, how we tell people who's our enemy, how we manipulate people in order to get them to accept whatever decisions the country makes on their behalf, even the decision of blowing up the entire planet. You never ask questions when God's on your side. So this is a great song on a number of levels. It really looks at the way education was being used. It really looks at the way that we should receive our information. It argues what Dylan always tries to argue. Be very careful what you listen to. Be very careful what information you accept. And always, always, always think for yourself. In the song Only a Pawn in Their Game, Bob Dylan takes another step forward, and he really separates himself from the others. Other singers wrote about the death of Medgar Evers, and they wrote general folky, isn't this awful, wasn't he a hero kind of songs. Bob Dylan's going to really delve into this and look at not just the fact that this man was murdered, but let's ask ourselves, who murdered him? Back then, we didn't know. We have found out since then. The man who murdered him was eventually convicted. But it was about, what, 20 years after the fact? There was a movie made about that. Well, we're getting a lot of these kind of incidents at this time. Civil rights students being killed. Civil rights leaders being killed. Of course, more are going to be killed. And so Bob Dylan begins this song almost like it's a mystery novel. A bullet from the back of a bush took Medgar Evers' blood. A finger fired the trigger to his name. A handle hit out in the dark. A hand set the spark. Two eyes took the aim. Behind a man's brain. But he can't be blamed. He's only a pawn in their game. People wrote about this song. Oh, he's apologizing for the person who killed it. No. He's trying to go a step further than just saying somebody shot this guy. He's looking at what are the forces that set this out there. A South politician preaches to the poor white man, "You got more than the blacks, don't complain, you're better than them. You got born with white skin," they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remain on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. Okay, now look what we're looking at. The way in which the have-nots are always divided. The way in which scapegoats are always found. This happens many times in history. Adolf Hitler is going to blame the Jews for losing World War I. The white politician named in this song is going to tell the whites who don't have a job, it's because of the blacks. Right now, we have somebody who became elected president in large part by telling the whites who don't have jobs, it's because of the immigrants. You find an outsider to blame, and you blame them. The deputy sheriffs, the soldiers, the governors get paid, and the marshals and cops get the same. But the poor white man's used in the hands of them all like a tool. He's taught in his school, from the start by the rule, that the laws are with him to protect his white skin, to keep up his hate so he never thinks straight about the shape that he's in. But it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. Today, Medgar Evers was buried from the bullet he caught. They lowered him down as a king. But when the shadowy sun sets on the one that fired the gun, he'll see by his grave on the stone that remains, carved next to his name, his epitaph plain. Only a pawn in their game. That, friends, is a very thoughtful piece of music. That is looking at what's happening in the country and making a statement about it. Making a statement about how the process of divide and conquer is being used by politicians for their gain. Looking at who's really to blame for Medgar Evers' death. You know, you can hop around and blame each of these soul assassins, but when there's an entire system going on in much of the South, isn't that where we ought to be looking? Isn't that what we need to be seeing? A system created purposely to create the people who will go out there and hide behind a bush and put a bullet into Medgar Evers as he's coming home one night. On the night John Kennedy made his famous civil rights speech, comes home to see his family, and is shot in front of his family, in front of his wife, in front of his children. Bob separated himself from all the other folk singers of his time by really looking at that and really grasping what's going on and really dealing with it. And by juxtaposing the burials of these two people, he minimizes the assassin. He shows him for what he is, which is nothing. A guy who let other people think for him. A guy who let himself be manipulated. Medgar Evers is lowered like a king. Medgar Evers we recall today. I don't remember the name of the guy who shot him. I read a book about him once. I don't remember his name because he's nothing. He's meaningless. I could have looked it up on the computer, but it's better this way, isn't it? Now, there's a number of other songs Dylan wrote that are about historical subjects. He wrote about Israel in Infidels called Neighborhood Bully. He wrote The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. He wrote Hurricane. He sings Dixie. You can get that from the soundtrack of Masked and Anonymous, and it is definitely worth getting. But I'm going to leave us off with a song he wrote recently called Cross the Green Mountain, which is his major attempt at discussing the Civil War. We know he cares a lot about the Civil War, is interested about it because he writes about it in his book, talks about going to the library in New York and reading about it. I also know because I caught a line that he had taken from an Abraham Lincoln speech. Now, it's very exciting. Bob Dylan uses all sorts of different things. He uses movies. You'll find things in Humphrey Bogart movies. And when you hear something that's from a Bob Dylan line, it's always very exciting. But my most exciting was when I was reading a Carl Sandburg's Abraham Lincoln and reading this anti-liquor speech that Abraham Lincoln made, and immediately recognized a line from a recent song in which Dylan sings, "They're sucking the blood out of genius and generosity." Well, that came from a Lincoln speech. He said, "If we take the habitual drunkards as a class, their heads and their hearts will bear an advantageous comparison with those of any other class. There seems ever to have been a proneness in the brilliant and warm-blooded to fall into this vice. The demon of intemperance ever seems to have delighted in sucking the blood of genius and generosity." So, you know, Bob, he saw that line and he said, well, I'm going to use that. But let's talk about Cross the Green Mountain.